Republicans in the state legislature are proposing a constitutional amendment to exempt houses of worship from government restrictions during a state emergency. It's Tuesday, August 8th. This is Wisconsin Today. Good morning. I'm Alex Crow. Coming up, there's a shortage of in-home care workers in Wisconsin. UW Green Bay is partnering with the Department of Health Services to address that gap. Rich Kramer will have more. And we'll have part two of our series, How We Got Here, Abortion in Wisconsin Since 1849. WPR reporters are diving into how the 174-year-old law was enforced. Stay with us.
Gardening in Wisconsin is a year-round job, and Garden Talk is here for you throughout every season. We help you battle relentless pests and pick your favorite mulch. We also cover how to care for houseplants and successful methods for starting seeds inside. We want to know what keeps your garden growing. Join me, Larry Mueller, for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network, Fridays at 11 and Saturday mornings at 6, or online anytime.
Houses of worship would be exempt from public emergency orders under a proposed constitutional amendment. As Anya Van Wagtendonk reports, the GOP proposal stems from the COVID-19 pandemic.
The proposed amendment would update the religious freedom section of the Wisconsin State Constitution. It would exclude houses of worship from government restrictions during a state of emergency. That would include public health emergencies like a pandemic. Representative Ty Bodden, a Republican of Hilbert, said churches should not have been closed during COVID-19.
It is a shared belief that places of worship should never face the unjust wrath of government and be forced to close its doors.
During the early months of COVID-19, Governor Tony Evers capped public gatherings at 10 people. He previously vetoed similar legislation about houses of worship. A constitutional amendment would bypass his veto powers. It would need to pass the legislature twice and then be approved by voters. Anya Van Wagtendonk, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Two Milwaukee women have been charged with hate crimes after police say they attacked a group of Muslim women in a park late last month. The women face one felony charge and five misdemeanor charges each after allegedly attacking the Muslim women in Cathedral Square Park in downtown Milwaukee. The women and about 10 children were in the park on July 30th when the attackers reportedly began yelling at them and punched two of the women, tearing off their hijabs. Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm says the hate crime modifier means they could face more jail time, but the felony charge of substantial battery is more important.
Because in Wisconsin, a hate crime is considered an enhancer. In other words, you have to still prove your underlying substantive offense. And then if you prove that, then you also have to add the potential increase in penalty.
This is the 10th hate crime charge in Milwaukee County in about 10 years. The number of people seeking in-home care in Wisconsin is growing, and the number of direct care workers is not keeping up. Rich Kramer reports on a new initiative to certify 10,000 more over the next 3 years.
Direct care workers assist senior citizens and people with disabilities who want to stay in their homes. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services projects the state will need 20,000 more direct care workers by next year. To partially address the gap, UW Green Bay and DHS are offering free online certification and bonuses for those looking to get into the field. University Director of Continuing Education Margie Reichwald says the certification can open up doors in the healthcare profession.
Say they're in caregiving for a year, but they want to go on to be a CNA. This is kind of like a career path and a resume builder for them to start that career in healthcare.
The free certification is funded by the American Rescue Plan Act passed in 2021. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
New research shows the prevalence of antibiotic-resistant bacteria varies based on location in Wisconsin. The study mapped cases of E. coli from three different healthcare systems to show where antibiotics were less effective against infections. Lucas Schultz is a pharmacy manager for UW Health who co-authored the study. He says antibiotic resistance is a growing problem both in Wisconsin and across the U.S. While it's too early to use the maps for making treatment decisions, Schultz says the research could improve care in the future.
Long term, as this database grows and the ability to map this grows, it becomes a more powerful tool.
Schultz says the maps could also help identify areas where both doctors and veterinarians need to change the way they're using antibiotics to stop the development of drug resistance. Coming up, reporter Hope Kerwin will explain how Wisconsin's 1849 abortion ban was initially enforced. Stay with us.
Thank you to the donors who make Wisconsin Public Radio possible. There are more than 50,000 of you. Your generosity delivers essential news, thought-provoking conversations, and inspiring music to listeners all over Wisconsin and beyond. Your support makes a difference in people's lives every day. Thank you.
And finally, a challenge to Wisconsin's abortion ban could already be making its way to the state Supreme Court. The law was first passed in 1849 and went back into effect last June when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. In our series, How We Got Here, Abortion in Wisconsin Since 1849, WPR reporters explore how the ban came to be and how Wisconsinites have lived with and without it since. In part two of our series, WPR's Hope Kerwin looked into how the ban was enforced. She spoke with All Things Considered host Brady Carlson.
Hope, in practice, how total was this near-total abortion ban?
It's clear that abortions continue to take place across the state after the ban was put in place. We don't have complete figures, but historians say there's a lot of evidence of this. And even the State Medical Society, which had backed the ban, acknowledged that illegal abortion was still happening regularly.
Then how common was it for prosecutors to bring charges against someone under this law?
Not very common, as far as we can tell. A researcher who surveyed available county court records from 1849 to 1900 found only 17 cases during those 50 years. And of those 17, only 5 were found guilty. We talked to Marquette University law professor Lisa Mazey. She said undoubtedly people were still having abortions. They just weren't being prosecuted for them.
That procedure is sort of inherently a very private, personal one, right? And so in order to find out that it has happened, you need people to tell you, to tell law enforcement.
So as long as no one admitted being involved in the abortion, or as it was often called in the newspapers then, an illegal operation, then police and prosecutors wouldn't have evidence that an abortion had taken place.
And without that evidence, they couldn't prosecute. But there was an effort to increase enforcement of abortion bans starting in the mid-20th century, partly because surgical abortions were becoming more popular. But Lauren McIver-Thompson told us it was also part of a broader focus on enforcing anti-obscenity laws. She is a history professor at Kennesaw State University in Georgia who studies birth control and abortion in the 20th century.
They're lumping in illegal abortion alongside all kinds of illicit sex, whether it's, you know, same-sex sex or heterosexual sex outside of marriage.
But even during that push to enforce the law, they would have had to find some proof that the law had been broken, correct?
Yes. And what usually prompts officials to bring charges under the abortion ban is the death of someone who's pregnant. Let's look at the case of Hazel Williamson from Wanakee. In 1943, Williamson traveled to Milwaukee with a list of 3 doctors her fiancé had given her. The 34-year-old was a farmer's daughter, an active member of the Wanakee Women's Club, and one of many women working in a factory during World War II. She was also 2 to 5 months pregnant. She chose the first name on her list, Dr. Edmund Tim.
And we'll come back to that list in a moment, but what happens when she goes to Dr. Tim?
Tim sent Williamson to what was called a lying-in home, used by people seeking an abortion. Reports say at least 5 abortion patients were staying at this house when Williamson was there. Williamson returned to Tim's office for an operation. A witness later testified she said Tim was, quote, like a horse doctor, and that the operation hurt her. That evening, she started running a fever. 2 days later, Tim performed a second procedure on Williamson. Early the next morning, she died from sepsis and a uterine hemorrhage.
So the authorities would have taken Dr. Tim's treatment of Williamson as evidence that he was responsible for her death and the death of the fetus.
Plus, Tim arrived at the lying-in home shortly after Williamson's death. And before he called the coroner, he went through her purse to find that list of doctors and ripped his name off the top. But Tim was still charged with second-degree manslaughter under the state's abortion law.
And ultimately, he was found guilty. So this case highlights that people knew where to get an abortion, and in large cities like Milwaukee, there was an industry, even if it was small and underground, that was supporting abortion procedures.
Right. Williamson's procedure was clearly botched, but McIver Thompson says it was probably unusual at the time.
We do start seeing more surgical abortions being performed in the early 20th century than we did in the 19th century, just as kind of medical advancements in surgery are made, things become a little bit safer. And in fact, by the 1930s, surgical abortion is actually pretty safe.
Were doctors and other practitioners the only ones charged under the law?
That mostly appears to be the case. But there was a prosecution in 1933 of a 28-year-old Madison woman named Lily Cordio. Cordio was charged with performing an illegal operation on 25-year-old Elizabeth Rip. Rip was the girlfriend of Cordio's younger brother and was hospitalized after a miscarriage. Police questioned her just hours before she died, and that's when she implicated Cordio. Cordio admitted that she told Rip how to end a pregnancy, but she was adamant that she wasn't directly involved and told Rip it was dangerous. She said Rip came to her house, went into her bathroom, and a few minutes later came out and announced that she had done it. McIver Thompson says this scenario is not surprising.
That was a knowledge that was shared by women passed down at the kitchen table, you know, over cups of coffee. You know, you would share what methods had worked.
Was there evidence Cordio may have performed the abortion?
Police did find medical instruments in Cordio's home, but McIver Thompson says you could order dilation instruments and vaginal probes from the Sears catalog or any drugstore.
On the one hand, yes, those things can be used to perform an abortion on yourself, but they also were used for other reasons, you know, women seeking to treat themselves at home for vaginal and uterine problems.
Cordio initially faced three charges: second-degree manslaughter for Rip's death, performing an illegal operation, and advising Rip on how to perform the abortion. Only the last charge, which was brought under the state's morality laws, makes it to trial. In the end, Cordio is found guilty and is sentenced to 6 months in county jail.
Let's talk a little bit more about the morality laws that you mentioned in talking about a case of an unmarried Racine woman in 1922.
Anna Young obtained an abortion when she was between 6 and 8 weeks pregnant and was hospitalized after the procedure. Young lived, but police found out about her case, and that led to the arrest of Dr. A. M. Foster. Foster claimed he did not perform an abortion, but a jury found him guilty. But then Foster sued the state. He claimed that even if he had performed the abortion, he shouldn't be convicted under the state's abortion ban. He argued the state's morality laws applied to his case because Young's pregnancy was so early on.
There are these statutes related to abortion that the legislature created in 1858, cataloged under offenses against chastity, morality, and decency. One of them made it illegal to help a woman procure a miscarriage.
And the state Supreme Court ended up agreeing with Foster. Quote, a 2 months embryo is not a human being in the eye of the law, and therefore its destruction constitutes an offense against morality and not against lives and persons. Lisa Mazey told us the court essentially assumes the morality laws were created to cover situations that involved a fetus that wasn't yet a person.
The court tries to make sense of legislative enactments. Right? And they're trying to think there had to be a logical reason they did what they did.
This interpretation stood until the 1950s, that abortions in early pregnancy are covered by the morality laws. In 1955, the state legislature eliminated the morality laws and clarified that an unborn child, quote, meant a human being from the time of conception. That meant anyone who terminated a pregnancy at any stage could be arrested and charged under the abortion ban.
That was WPR's Hope Kerwin speaking with Brady Carlson for our series, How We Got Here, Abortion in Wisconsin Since 1849. You can find more from this series at WPR.org/1849. And that'll do it. Thanks for joining us for Wisconsin Today. I'm your host, Alex Crow, and our producers were Mallory Chang and John Davis. As always, you can catch us every weekday morning wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us that rating and review. Have a great day. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.